I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm joined today by a very special guest, Jared Taylor. Jared, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we have actually spent quite a bit of time together recently in Europe, and I thought we would just have a conversation about it and answer a few questions from the audience if there are questions out there. So, ever since 2011, I have been doing retreats, weekend retreats for Countercurrents writers and donors and friends. And we've had a lot of very distinguished people at these events. For instance, we had Jonathan Bowden speak early on back in 2012. We had Charles Kraft speak a number of times. Mark Weber has spoken. Kevin McDonald has spoken. And my guest, also, Jared Taylor, has been at a couple of these events. And we recently had one in the Eternal City itself in Rome. I wanted to do it in Rome because we had done a few Euro retreats in the past in sort of out-of-the-way places, in little countries that people had not really heard of, cities with unpronounceable names. And I thought, okay, I want to make this an easy sell. So I said, Rome. Everybody who hasn't been to Rome will say, yes, Rome. Everybody who's been to Rome will say, yeah, I could go to Rome again. And so we set it up to be in Rome. And Jared was one of our speakers. Also, Kevin Deanna, also associated with American Renaissance, was there. And Colin Cleary, who writes for Countercurrents. F. Roger Devlin, who writes for Countercurrents, as well as Amren. Endeavor, a number of people were there. Keith Woods was there. And I thought it was a great time. But enough of my impressions. Jared, tell us your thoughts about Rome.
Oh my gosh, I have so many thoughts about Rome. And this is not a paid political announcement, ladies and gentlemen. It was an absolutely wonderful time, as was the retreat that I went on in Ljubljana, one of those unpronounceable names in an obscure but wonderful country known as Slovenia. But as for Rome, well, I had not been there since I was 19 years old. And I like to think that in the intervening all too many years, I have developed a certain amount of maturity, and I was able to appreciate it in a way that I never could have as a teenager. I feel as though I devoured Rome. There's so many things to say about Rome. But to me, one of the great experiences of being there on this occasion was to get acquainted with Casa Pound, which is the venue in which we held the meetings. This was really another experience that brought back to me how important it is to have brick and mortar presence. I don't know if, well, I'm sure because you've thought of so many things, Greg Johnson, you've thought about this before, but we have so few examples of any kind of brick and mortar presence of any kind of nationalist movement here in the United States, whereas in Europe, they're far, far, far ahead of us. And these are such wonderful places where it seems for the most part, it's young people who get together. But in the case of Casa Pound, people of all ages get together for these face-to-face experiences that are so crucial to developing any kind of real world solidarity. And also, I think, for sussing out and examining people who are potential leaders. But enough for me on that subject. We can get to the whole question of Rome, if that is one that interests you, from the sort of tourist or, let us say, Western civilization appreciating tourist. Really, Rome struck me in two ways. One was just the utter magnificence of what the Italians once were, or twice were, if you include the ancient Romans. The ancient Romans, just the extraordinary engineering of which they were capable, the organization, the military conquests. And then in the case of the Renaissance Italians, the Renaissance Romans, what extraordinary artistic cultural achievements they were capable of then. And again, I have just so many thoughts on this subject. My brain is just flooded with impressions for those, I guess, about 4 or 5 days I spent in Rome. Any of those would be things to talk about. But are we allowed to talk in some detail about Casa Pound?
Yes, I actually cleared that with our friend and contact, Sebastian. He says, talk about us as much as you want. He said, thank you for choosing us. Thank you for coming. So I was very pleased with that.
Excellent.
So yeah, let me back up a little bit.
Yes.
Last year I was in Rome and I was walking down a street named for Napoleon III. And I looked up and I saw a flag that was familiar and a building that was familiar. And that was the Casa Pound headquarters. It's in the Esquilino neighborhood, not far from the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore. And I had been so wrapped up with ancient Rome and medieval and Renaissance Rome that I'd forgotten about what's going on there today, which is important for our broader cause. And so I reached out to Guido Taietti, who's affiliated with them, and said, can you give me some contact info? He immediately sent me the contact of Sebastian. And I WhatsApped him, and he immediately wrote back, which immediately impressed me, because that's one of the habits of effective nationalists, is to get right back to people. He said, come by the bar, meet me this evening, we'll talk. And so I did. The next day, I had a tour of their headquarters and their bookstore. That evening, I went to this pub called the Cutty Sark, where they hang out. And I was very impressed because not only do they have a headquarters in Rome itself, but in the 23 years that they've existed since creating that headquarters, they've gotten affiliated businesses and living spaces and gyms and things like that all over Italy. In every political region of Italy, Casa Pound is there. And so they have some thousands of people. And within Rome itself, they can get hundreds of people to show up in 90 minutes if they have an emergency, which is great. And so I wanted to study this group. I spent some time talking with Sebastian and other people involved with it. They introduced me to more people. And I was impressed with the scale of real world organization and how effective and pragmatic and rational they all are. Sebastian is a very intelligent guy, extremely diplomatic, which I can see is a great value in organizing people. They have an ethos where they live, they're mostly in this very multicultural neighborhood, the Esquilino district, yet they weren't complaining about stuff. They were living their lives. They're aware of all the problems. They act politically against these problems. They've created a good life for themselves in their community. Yet there's not a lot of just ordinary day-to-day, ain't it awful kind of stuff, which I thought was an interesting little touch. They're very good at building community amongst themselves and loyalty. That's quite clear. And they have a somewhat pan-European sensibility, even though they're rooted very much in Italy and its traditions. So Sebastian, for instance, is French. They named it after Ezra Pound, an American poet. And they have very good, widespread diplomatic relations with people in the movement from all over the white world, basically. And I was a little intimidated reaching out. And as soon as I heard back, I was made to feel very welcome. They were very friendly and outgoing. And I just found it a very constructive ethos that they have. And I thought I would like to share this with people from America, especially because we don't have anything like this in America. And yes. So that was one of the reasons initially I thought, well, we'll do it in Rome. We'll do it the normal way. We'll get a hotel as a venue. And we'll try and include a tour of Casa Pound. But I also wanted to keep money in our greater cause. And so I reached out to arrange for them to cater because they have a number of businesses, including restaurants that are affiliated. And in the back of my mind, I was really hoping that we could actually use a conference room they have on their top floor named after Dominic Venner. And when that came together, I was very, very pleased. They treated us very well, and they gave us a great tour. They helped us with all the catering and hosting. Some of their people spoke on a panel for us. And I thought that the reaction, especially from the Americans, was well, you're one of the people I'll gauge the reaction from. But people like Paul Wagner, the Wolves of Inland, were there. Kevin Diana was there. And I thought they really hit it off with the Casa Pound people. And I was very, very encouraged by that, because I hope some of the ideas and ethos that I saw there might come back to the States and seed some similar initiatives.
I think the general sensation among the Americans was admiration, almost to the point of awe, because, as you say, we have nothing like this. The building right there in downtown Rome, smack, it would be like in midtown Manhattan, having a 7-story building right on Park Avenue. There's more than 15,000 square feet in this building. They use it for all sorts of purposes. Just the idea of having such an establishment in the heart of the worst opposition to our ideas, that mere fact alone is astonishing. They also have, as I understand it, more than 70 or 80 other branches. They might be bookstores, pubs, cultural spaces, social centers, all of this to give them access to community building all around Italy and all regions of Italy. This is really very, very impressive to me. I had been only tangentially aware of Casa Pound because the fellow that you mentioned, Guido Taglietti, I had invited him to speak at an American Renaissance conference. But years ago, he got into a, well, let's call it an unpleasant encounter with some Antifa, and the Antifa ended up rather getting the worst of the encounter. And for that reason, he's under a kind of judicial supervision and would have had to have the permission of a judge to leave the country, and the judge said no. So he appeared by video. Now, one thing that he did say was that even speaking as a loyal member of Casa Pound, something that he did regret about his organization is that it is so deeply rooted in Italy. Now, that was a conversation we had, I guess, 3 or 4 years ago. But certainly, speaking to Dominic, as you did, I also got the impression that they are making a much better effort to try to establish ties with racially conscious white people all around Europe and the United States. I also had a very positive impression of Dominic. He is a Frenchman.
Sebastian.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Yes, Sebastian. Yes, how could I have made such a mistake? Sebastian. He is a Frenchman, and he is in charge of international relations. He speaks French. He speaks English. He speaks Italian. All of that helps. He and I had several very good jabbers in French, and I found him to be charming, well-informed, and, as you say, extremely diplomatic. Just the perfect guy to have in charge of establishing relations with non-Italian groups. So this complaint that Guido Taglietti had himself about his own organization, and he was, of course, very proud of the kind of brick-and-mortar presence they have all throughout Italy. He regretted the fact that Casa Pound seemed to be primarily rooted in Italy, but that is branching out. So, as I say, all of the Americans, I mean, even if the only building they had was that one in Rome, it would be breathtaking. But we were all just in the deepest admiration. The only equivalent that I can think of are the active clubs, the martial arts clubs and the bodybuilding gyms that we have in just a few places popping up. But nothing like, we don't have a single pub or a bookstore or anything that you could call a cultural center. And they have these all over Italy. This is something I think we should really strive for. And I'm especially impressed with this because in two other countries that I've visited recently, I was impressed by the same thing. I was invited to give a talk and take in Leuven. That's a university town in Belgium. And I was invited by the Nationalist Student Association. This association is 50 years old, and it is something that was set up originally as a Flemish nationalist organization. And it is still Flemish nationalist, but its main thrust now has come to focus on remigration. And they have this institutional presence there. They have places where they go drinking together. They have a broom. They have a songbook. and they get together and sing. I'm very, very envious of this. I wish we had clubs where we got together and sang. I don't know about you, but I think certainly men singing together and men and women singing together, there is just a wonderful sense of community that singing together builds, and they make the most of this. So that was in Belgium. Also in Belgium, I was invited to the headquarters of the Vlaams Belang, which is the most nationalist of the political parties there. They have a wonderful bar in the basement of their building. And this is another place where people get together, they drink, they socialize, they get to know each other better, and they too sing. Singing is something that I think Americans are almost embarrassed of. The best thing, the best we can ever manage is an occasional Christmas carol or sing Happy Birthday. But these wonderful patriotic songs that they sing together, I think that's a wonderful sentiment-building experience. But again, this is based on a brick-and-mortar presence. In Angers, in France, I was also invited to give a talk by a student group. They have a three-story building. It's much more modest than the one that Casa Pound has in Rome, but they also have a big, full basement. And I spoke to a group of about 60 students. There was plenty of room for me to talk to this group of people. And they, too, had a bar. Afterwards, we all went out to their bar. It reminded me of Prohibition-era speakeasies, because it's on just a regular street, but you had to get buzzed in. You had to get checked out before they would let you in, because there are obviously certain people that they can't let in. But the fact that they have this place where they have meetings, they have a bar where people get together. It was mostly men, but there was a delightful sprinkling of young women as well. All of this, I think, is so important. And I don't know why the Europeans are so far advanced compared to us. I was thinking about perhaps the reasons. Now, as I'm sure you recall, the seven-story building right there in the center of Rome on Via Napoleon III, no less, it was originally a government building, but they took it over as a squat. And they've had it, 27 years now? They've hung on to this building. I beg your pardon, 23?
23, yeah.
Yes, despite the court cases and eviction notices and everything else. I think if we tried that, we would get the Branch Davidian treatment, or we'd get the Ruby Ridge treatment. There's just no way that you could get away with something like that. And despite the fact that, say, for example, in the university town in France where I was, they were careful about letting people in and not letting people in. And they did have a kind of a hotline set up. People were on alert so they could be called if there was trouble. I didn't see any graffiti. I didn't see any of the things that we would expect if, for example, American Renaissance had a little bar in town someplace. I think it'd be very, very difficult to operate without constantly having your windows smashed and graffiti, police looking the other way. I don't know quite how they manage it. Maybe it's because there are so many such establishments in Europe that Antifa have given up on them, but there's something about the way they have organized there that permits them to get together regularly, some people almost on a daily basis, some of these students. They get together, they have a couple of drinks together, they have some songs. It's really a wonderful, wonderful thing, and I wish we could arrive at that level of organization and brick-and-mortar presence.
I completely agree. The active club movement is something that's very much inspired by Casa Pound, too, because Rob Rundo actually visited Casa Pound and got to know the people there, and he took inspiration from that. And I think that that's a further example of their positive influence on people from the United States. There are some reasons, I think, for the remarkable success of brick-and-mortar institutions in Europe as opposed to America. One is that American people in general, but also American nationalists in particular, are very spread out. We're not close enough to one another. That you need a certain number of people in a vicinity to have a symphony orchestra or a Casa Pound. There's not that critical mass. When I was told that Casa Pound can get on the phone and call up 300 people at any time of the day in Rome, and they'll come out to defend the place if need be, I thought that was remarkable. And of course, they have hundreds and hundreds of more people that they know and that are friendly with them, but they probably couldn't get them to rush to the headquarters in the middle of the night. We just don't have a dense enough group of people like that in the United States to start having these brick and mortar things, because I do think that, yes, they would be targets in America in a way that they're not targets in Rome. Now, in Rome, there are like 60 buildings that have been taken over by Antifa where they squat, or apartments. And I do not know if they've been as harassed as Casa Pound has by the city of Rome, but the fact that they're still there after 23 years is very interesting. There's something up with the Italian justice system that it's taken 23 years and they still haven't been evicted.
That's a legal difference, clearly. You simply could not take over somebody else's building, especially right in the middle of a city. You hear these horror stories about Britain, for example. Somebody goes on vacation, comes home, and their nice little villa is taken over by gypsies, and they can't get them out. The squatting laws are simply different, and I guess Casa Pound is taking advantage of that. Now, I think that part of it, in the case of Americans, it's not just that we're spread out. I think there is almost a timidity about coming above ground. I remember, back in the old days of Insteration magazine. Insteration was excessively below ground, but Wilmot Robertson, who was the editor at the time, he wouldn't let anybody write under his own name. And even the people who wrote in letters to the editor, they used only zip codes, a kind of fearfulness. And this is something that I think Americans need to get over. We're, of course, afraid of being doxxed, so many of us. And I think the idea of having something out in the open that's clearly ours, there's a kind of psychological intimidation that we have to overcome. Now, one example that is a little bit different, and I believe this is the form that brick and mortar is increasingly going to take in the United States, is the example of the New York Young Republicans. Now, I don't suppose you've ever been to their gala. Every year they have a big gala in New York City. It's this black tie thing, and it costs, I think, $600 to attend. This is one of the most elegant kind of evenings you're likely to ever attend. But the one time when I was there, blow me, if they didn't have representatives from Orania. And it was very close, as it happened, to the Day of the Vow, which is the day on which, just before the Battle of Blood River, the Voortrekkers all vowed that if God delivered their enemies into their hands, they would keep the Day of the Vow holy as a holiday and build a church in God's name. And there is a vow that they gave, and this is something that Afrikaners do every year. And right there in the middle of New York City, in the middle of this black tie gala, we all got on our feet and we repeated after the Afrikaners the words of the vow, for heaven's sake. This is the kind of place the New York Republicans has become. Now, I was very surprised that the journalists who were there, and they were strategically kept on the other side of velvet ropes, so they couldn't just mingle with the audience. They did catch sight of me, and they wrote about the fact that, this wicked Jared Taylor was in the audience. I guess they were such boneheads, such ignoramuses, that they didn't write about what to me was just the most flagrantly white nationalist act of the whole thing, the Day of the Vow. They didn't even write about that at all. But this is the kind of place that the Young Republicans in New York City are becoming. And my guess is that more and more Young Republicans, college Republicans, conservative groups, even, and I think this is a possibility, old Elks lodges, or maybe even Masonic lodges that are begging for members, they will be slowly taken over by sharp young guys who are willing to do the volunteer work. They then take control, and then the nature of the organization changes. But to me, one of the most spectacular examples of that is, as I say, the Young Republican Club. So it's not impossible. We can organize, and we can. I think what's going to happen is that we're more likely to just take over existing institutions of one kind or another, rather than building, or they're going to be variants of these active clubs. And I agree with you. I'm very happy that certainly the young people that are racially conscious in the United States are very physical fitness oriented. And when you see over and over all of these videos that circulate on X and Instagram of all of these poor white people being beaten up by blacks, it is very encouraging when sometimes you see the table turned and some spunky young white guy throws a black guy head over heels, knocks him out. I think it's very good for our guys to be physically fit and able to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. But that's a start in the United States. And then, as I say, the other branch of this is going to be infiltration and takeover of existing organizations. One thing I must say, in all of these organizations, if you are willing to join and do a lot of the scut work, there's scut work in all of these. They need volunteers to do things. And they are mm-hmm. just pathetically grateful if they can find somebody who's willing to spend the time doing it. You can become a valuable member, and then you can slowly persuade people to change the orientation of the organization. I believe that strikes me as the future more than, I don't know, American Renaissance or Countercurrents or some overtly nationalist group than establishing brick and mortar branches of it all around the country or in different parts of the state. Just taking over these ones that are already existing, that seems to me to be the more promising route in the United States. But who knows? In any case, I think Americans are definitely thinking in terms of this kind of physical presence, not just certainly an internet presence and an occasional conference presence, the way American Renaissance has operated all these years.
The far left has physical spaces in Europe. They have their squats, they have their bookstores, they have bars where they meet, things like that. They have public facing and vulnerable institutions. And if they attack the public-facing, vulnerable institutions of the right, they can expect the right to retaliate. And I think that, therefore, there is something of a balance of terror that exists, because the right is well-organized enough that they can not only defend their institutions, but they can also, because the left has hostages out there in their own public-facing institutions, I think that that might actually force them to be a little more circumspect in their dealings. I do think that's one possibility.
Well, that hadn't occurred to me, but you could very well be right. That could be a convincing argument. Of course, the left is so full of hotheads that you could get some kind of independent Antifa group that doesn't have any vulnerable institutions or brick and mortar of its own, just go off on some sort of rampage. Apparently, that probably does happen, but it would be really worth a serious investigation to see what is the cause of this real difference. I think part of it, of course, is that some of these organizations in Europe are affiliated with political parties. Now, there are a whole host of reasons why we don't have an equivalent of the Vlaams Belang or the FPO or the AfD in Germany. And once you have a political party and it's got a certain amount of office space, it's got organization, it's got people who work for it, then you're much more likely to have access to kind of a public institutional structure that can have a youth movement, for example. And these youth movements are always much more radical than the actual elected politicians. And there's a kind of it always strikes me as a kind of a strange symbiosis between them. I know that in Belgium, the political parties pretend to be a little nervous about the youth group, while they quietly encourage them. And the youth groups tend to complain about what fuddy-duddies the elected officials are. But the youth groups are a great opportunity to try to push the general discourse and some of the more reluctant elected officials in a more nationalist way. But I think affiliation with the political party, that is one avenue towards brick and mortar presence too, that we absolutely do not have.
Mm-hmm. In the case of Casa Pound, it started out, interestingly enough, it began as the fan group around a sort of hardcore rock band called Zeta Zero Alpha. And 23 odd years ago, a bunch of their fans were in Rome for a concert. And after the concert was over, a lot of them were wondering where they're going to sleep. And that's where the idea of breaking into this building, in this abandoned city-owned building in Escolino, and sleeping there and taking it over began.
Is that right? I didn't know that story.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
And It's interesting, in France, the identitarian movement in France also grew out of the fan base of a band. And the leaders of these two bands knew each other. They shared fan bases. And I actually wrote about this, and I talked about this in, it was years ago, you and I were both in Lithuania. We were in Vilnius for an event by the nationalists there. And I believe I talked about this then, that if you have a small band and it's successful, it's a small business, basically. And if you're good at running a band, you can run bigger things, businesses. And, you know, public performers, musicians who get up in front of a crowd and are energized by that, they're natural leaders. And so you have this combination of an extroverted type that can hold the attention of an audience. They've got a built-in audience for their music. They've got business skills if they manage to make the band successful. And it was a natural step in both countries for them to move into politics, which I thought was fascinating. And one of the things that I like about the Casa Pound people that I met is that they have a very populist sentiment. There are people from all levels of society involved in this. They're not snobs by any stretch of the imagination. I like that sensibility. Yet, what keeps it all going is that there are people in it who have business skills. There are a number of businesses that are affiliated with Casa Pound or overlap with Casa Pound. And the people who run them are good at running things. That's something that we should treasure. Anybody who comes to our milieu with business skills is somebody that needs to be embraced. They seem to have a lot of people like that. And I think that that's one of their strengths. Now, they did create a political party for a while, but then they set that aside. And I talked to one of the people in the group about that. And basically, they just decided that they were going to be more influential by being a community organization than a political party. And therefore, they're metapolitical, as I like to say, rather than directly political. But this is especially something that fits with Italy, because Italian nationalism has always flowed outside a lot of the mainstream institutions of society. It was always opposed by the church that wanted to hold on to the papal states. There were all these royal families and noble houses that were opposed to it, the House of Savoy being the big exception. But if you look at the history of Italian nationalism, one of the ways that it was organized was through community organizations like Freemasonry, which was very much on the outs with the Catholic Church. And the way I think Casa Pound works today, it's like a quote-unquote form of Freemasonry. It's a fraternal organization of people who are Italian nationalists from all walks of life who do things together and help one another out. And they create a community that's very attractive, and they do have initiatives like they will support particular political actors or initiatives and things like that. But they're not so much of a political party as a community organization. And I do think that that's a really valid model. And it seems to work especially well in Italy for some reason.
Well, it is fascinating that in Europe, you do find people who have been political, but then who decide that they can be more effective elsewhere. And a particular person I'm thinking of is Dries van Langenhove. He was elected to the Belgian Senate, one of the youngest people ever elected. And he was active in the Senate, made a huge stink there. But then he decided to drop out because he thought he could be more effective. He has set up boxing clubs, for example. And he has a kind of metapolitical organization, if you will, that he thinks he can be more effective, give his time to that. That's something almost unimaginable in the United States. If we had a U.S. congressman or even a state senator, and for heaven's sake, heavens forbid, a U.S. senator who decided, well, you know, I can make a big stink here in the U.S. Senate, but, you know, I can be more effective elsewhere. That would be unimaginable. Because we just don't have any other parallel organization where a man who had that kind of prominence ability could have more impact than he could in the United States Senate. Now, again, this gets us back to the whole question of what we don't have. I mean, we don't have different political parties. We don't have these parallel organizations. And it goes to show you that perhaps the grass is always greener on the other side, because I'm always fascinated to hear Europeans envious of our First Amendment, for example. And they say, "Why, you can say anything. You never go to jail." And then we say to them, "Wow, but look at your political parties. Look at your organizations." But this gets me back to the whole question of metapolitics. I know that metapolitics is... I wouldn't go so far as to call it a totemic word in your mind. And obviously, opinions have to change in order for politics to follow. But I'm almost a little impatient with metapolitics. We need to have politics. We need to have our hands on the levers of power. Time is running out. And if in Europe there's going to be remigration, if here in the United States we had a President Trump who was not a complete imbecile and idiot when it comes to foreign policy and a whole host of other, we needn't get into just how many. Let me count the ways in which Donald Trump, although he's done some wonderful things, has done some terrible things. If we had a guy like him who was not as crazy as he is in so many respects, the political answer has to come eventually. And sometimes I get the impression that in the United States and in Europe as well, people talk about metapolitics because they can't succeed in politics, which is ultimately where the decisions have to be made. We have to have power. And that, to me, is an orientation that I believe the United States is ripe for. Obviously, we have political parties in Europe, some of which are just explicitly remigration oriented. We have nothing like that in the United States. But again, like these institutions I was talking about, and as the young Republicans in New York City suggest, I think the Republican Party, at least at the local level, is vulnerable to a possible takeover. And I think that even independents in local elections, I like to point out that in the United States, there are 10,000 elected officials at all the different levels, maybe more, maybe less, but at least 10,000. Not a one of them, as far as I know, is an open white advocate. Not one. And it seems to me that at the very least, we could get somebody on a city council, on a county council. These things, eventually, we have to be out from underground. We have to be in the political arena, and we have to be in a position so that once we get even a little bit of power, even on a city council or a school board, we can make changes in the real world and not just talking about it on the internet.
Yeah, I agree. The whole purpose of metapolitics is to lay the groundwork for actual political power. And it is interesting to see people who have taken a step back from actual political power, because ultimately that's what we need. We actually need to be able to make the laws and enforce them.
Yes, yes.
Make new laws and enforce them. We're moving in the right direction, generally speaking, though. If you look at the attitudes of younger people in America and Europe, especially younger men, they're coming in our direction quite rapidly.
Unquestionably. It's so fascinating to me. Who is it that invites me to go speak in Belgium? A student group. Why is it that people of my generation, I'm just the classic boomer, my generation is fast asleep when it comes to racial politics and white advocacy. It's the people who are 50 years younger than I am, who are the ones who have got the bit between their teeth, who seem to understand far better than their parents or their grandparents what is at stake. Mm-hmm. And here in the United States, if I go to a group of ordinary Republicans, no one has an idea of who I am. If I go to a young Republican or college Republican meeting, the reaction is, gosh, Mr. Taylor, I had no idea you were going to be here. And they all want to come shake my hand and have their pictures taken. It's all very sweet and flattering. I just wish that it was the Republicans who had some measure of power who were listening to me or had some idea who I am. But obviously, it's far better to have people who are young, who are moving in our direction, rather than nothing but old people. So eventually the old people will move away from the scene and these young people will take over. But that's a generational process that's going to take a mighty long time.
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow's leaders. Let's just say that we're reaching tomorrow's leaders, and that's a very positive thing. So after you left us in Rome, you went to France and spoke somewhere. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your experiences there?
Well, certainly. That's what I mentioned, the student group in the university town of Angers. It's in Brittany. And that's yet another example of these are the people I talked about. I gave them a talk in the basement of their clubhouse, so to speak, and went out to a bar like a speakeasy. Only the right people could come in, but there were plenty of right people. The bar was crammed, and everybody was singing and jabbering, and all they wanted to come up and shake my hand. It was an absolutely wonderful time. In fact, this was a very interesting thing. This group had come up with a strange version of the Confederate battle flag that had the French lily in place of the stars. And right in the middle, they had the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And I never got a full explanation of what all the symbolism was, but this was an attempt to take the revolutionary ardor and the traditions of honor, courage, and loyalty of the South, and then graft onto them a kind of Catholic French nationalism. I've never seen such a thing. I took a picture of this this astonishing flag. It was hanging in their little clubhouse. And I really probably shouldn't even talk about it unless I could explain more what the symbolism of it was. But that was in effect what it was. It was attempting to build a nationalist sentiment on what they conceive of as the admirable qualities of the Confederacy. Yet another amazing difference between Europe and the United States. I remember seeing photographs during the Solidarity demonstrations in Poland, back when they were trying to throw off communism. Occasionally, you'd see a Confederate flag amongst those groups. All around Europe, the Confederacy is the sign of resistance against tyranny. It's heartwarming to see, especially for a Southerner like myself. But be that as it may, that was one of the reasons I was in France. Another was that I was invited by a group that called themselves in French Les Braves, and that simply means the brave ones. They are, interestingly enough, a little bit like Return to the Land here in the United States. They are inward looking. They are not trying to have a big internet profile. And this was a bit of a change for them. They wanted to interview me. We had a number of very, very good conversations. And they're going to post our interviews on their channel. This is a kind of a bit of an innovation for them, because mostly they build these French communities, not just in France, interestingly enough, but also in French expatriate communities. In Romania is one. I believe they have one in Budapest. And these are people who have simply decided to link up with other like-minded French people. They're very tight-lipped about how many such communities there are, how many people they are, but they are slowly reaching out, sort of coming above ground and communicating with other groups. The fascinating thing about this is I have a French friend, who came to the very first American Renaissance Conference. That was back in 1994, for heaven's sake. And we've been good friends ever since. He is very plugged into the nationalist scene in France. He had never even heard of them. But this is an example of, I think, the kind of thing that's happening everywhere. Groups that are establishing themselves either in an inward-looking, inward-facing form, the way les braves are, and then other people who are starting YouTube channels, who are putting together publishing houses. All of this is a kind of flourishing in every direction possible of racial consciousness. And I think it's a wonderful thing. And I plan to pursue further my contacts with Les Braves. And if they have a community in a place where you might wish to get acquainted with them, I suspect I might be able to introduce you. In any case, those were the two reasons why I left early and went to France. The other being, well, I just like being in France. I lived in France for a while. And it's always good to speak French, limber up the language that I used to be able to take examinations in and dazzle my oral examiners with my fluency. So that was another reason. I went simply because I like being in France, but I made a point of meeting with these nationalist groups and learning more about what they're up to. And it was then, after that, that, of course, we met again in Helsinki.
I read your article about that. I thought it was a very good summary. You were at the same conference that I was at in 2018, yes. The Finnish Awakening Conference.
Yes, that was the first one, was it not, in downtown Helsinki?
I believe so. It was the first or the second. I actually don't remember, but it was a nice large turnout. There was in a historic restaurant. There were a lot of nationalists from places like the UK who came and showed up. It was a great event. I very much enjoyed it. I remember Ramsey Paul was there. I remember you were there. I wanted to get back to Finland for a long time. Then COVID came along and basically shut the scene down for years. This gentleman, Tuukka, who is the organizer of it, he got it up and running again last year, I believe it was. I was really pleased at the chance to get back to Finland and see some of those folks. There were a lot of new faces. There were some old familiar faces there. It was a really warm welcome. I brought a suitcase of books, the ones that were left over from the Rome event, and I laid them out. At about 12:30, the event was supposed to start at 1, and they were all sold by the beginning of the event, which was very flattering. I wish I had more books with me. I really enjoyed it. I like the Finns. I like Finland a lot. I think Finland is a remarkably modern, attractive country. Everything works extremely well. The weather was beautiful. It was springtime, so it was sort of cool. Clear and sunny. It was a wonderful welcome. I gave the same talk that I gave in Rome, which is up at Countercurrents. It's called Eternal Glory. There was a warm reception to it. And I'm very hopeful for the Finns. I think that they have good people involved in this group. They come from all walks of society. There are some extremely educated people in the group, some very shrewd people who are accomplishing a lot. So it was great to finally get back and see my friends in Finland again.
Yes, I thought it was fascinating. There was a Romanian who spoke. There were a Serb, a Croat, and Finns. They have, I'm not quite sure how I can characterize it, but they have arguments and interests that are not necessarily exactly the same as ours. And it was very, very interesting to hear their perspective on what are, in effect, common problems. In Finland, and as you can see walking around Helsinki, I took an extra day and poked around for a while before I got on the plane to come home. It's such a wonderful city because, as you say, everything works, everything is clean. It's rather different from Rome in that respect. In Rome, it's a wonderful, exciting city in a whole host of ways, but it's not quite as clean as you think a first world city should be. Broken sidewalks here and there, pothole here, pothole there. None of that in Helsinki. Everything is just as Scandinavian as can be from that point of view. And so many handsome buildings. I didn't expect there to be so many really quite impressive classical looking buildings, and even several in a distinctly, what I learned later, Finlandish kind of architecture. Their National Museum has a wonderful collection of these surprisingly, well, I guess surprising is an insulting word to say, but really quite good Finnish artists, as well as a collection of excellent art from all around the West. I was very, very impressed with just the streetscape, the sense of security and cleanliness and good functioning of Helsinki. And black people are so rare, it's almost a jolt to see one walking by. And later when I posted about this on X, I was told, well, you never went to the blah, blah, blah neighborhood. Well, no, I guess I didn't go. And so there apparently are parts of Helsinki where a certain amount of diversity has wormed its way in. But certainly compared to other Western capitals, it's a delightfully white place. It reminded me of the Baltic states in that respect. Very, very few, very, very few non-whites. And to me, the great thing about Tuukka Kuru's awakening conferences and his political group, which is called the Blue and Black organization. I meant to ask him where the colors come from, but it's called the Blue and Black. I'm glad it's not Black and Blue. In any case, it's the Blue and Black Association. They do plan to run candidates. I don't believe they've elected anyone yet, but it is it is intended to be a political movement. But they, like increasing numbers of whites who live in relatively untouched European countries, they can look across the border and they can tell, they can see that what's happening in what's happening in France, what's happening in Britain, what's happening in Italy, these are horrible mistakes, and they want to head it off absolutely as soon as they possibly can. And yet, even in a place like Finland, you have these multi-culti types who seem to think that modernism requires having boatloads of Muslims and Africans and these incomprehensible people living amongst you. This just seems to be a worldwide white man's disease. But I'm very, very happy that Tuukka Kuru and his movement is battling this before it becomes anything like the terrible problem it is for so many other countries.
I completely agree. I remember the first time we were there, we were having lunch after our arrival, and there were competing demonstrations in Helsinki. The Afghans who live in Helsinki were having a demonstration protesting Pakistan for its treatment of Afghans, and the Pakistanis who were living there were counter-protesting the Afghans. And so you had a war from South Asia that was basically being fought out more politely because of the police separating them in the capital of Finland. I thought that was rather extraordinary. But yes, overall, the feel of it is it's very different from New York City, for instance, in terms of the demographics.
That's hardly a compliment. That's a very low bar.
It is a very low bar, yeah.
I had forgotten this Afghan-Pakistani demonstration, counter-demonstration. Good grief, I must have repressed that. That seems like such a horrible thing to find in the streets of Helsinki, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, that was our welcome to Finland moment. And I thought, oh no, I'm so glad we have people organizing here against this. I didn't see anywhere near as many non-Europeans this time, 8 years later, as I saw back then, which is fascinating to me. There were a couple of changes that I noticed in 8 years. Mm-hmm. One of them was the amount of Mumintroll merchandise for sale had shot up dramatically. There was Mumintroll stuff for, everywhere for sale, which I thought was kind of funny. Apparently, the Moomins have really caught on in Japan. Yes. And so it's sort of charming because it's a very cute cultural export. It's sort of like Sweden having ABBA as one of their major exports for a long time.
Well, yeah. My wife, who was with me, bought the very first Moomin book, and it was a series that began in the 1940s. And so it's all extremely wholesome. This is a book that she's going to give to a grandchild. I first learned of the movements when I was in Finland for the very first time, along with you. But I didn't spend any time in Helsinki, so I wasn't aware of the extent to which a Moomin merch has taken over. But right there in downtown Helsinki, there's a pretty large-sized store that is just pure Moomin. And that's where they sell all the books in English. I didn't see any in Japanese. I was looking. I'd heard that the Japanese love Moomins, and I was looking for Japanese translations. But I guess they don't have quite enough Japanese Japanese tourists to make it worthwhile to have the translations right there. But no, that's a great thing to have as a national export. The other thing is, I don't believe that you were there at the very end of the conference, but afterwards, there is a sauna attached to the building where we held our conference. And afterwards, all the menfolk bounded down to the sauna, and we jumped out of our clothes, sizzled in the sauna, and a few hearty women folk joined us. Now they were allowed to cover up a little bit, but they weren't the least disturbed by all of these buck naked people that they these men that they'd been to the conference with. Now that struck me as a very kind of camaraderie building experience too. You get there and you sweat together. That was just the perfect ending to it. And after we got out of the sauna, we sat around and barbecued sausages together. I felt like an honorary Finn. And the Finns, as you know, can't live without their saunas. It's these days, practically every detached house in Finland has a built-in sauna. Any apartment building, if it's a fancy apartment building, the apartments have their individual saunas. If not, at least somewhere in the building, there is a sauna that you can use. I have actually seen health studies according to which Finns apparently, the reason allegedly is because of their frequent saunaing, that they have better health outcomes because of all of this heating that they go through. I don't know, but they certainly are attached to their saunas.
I don't want to keep you too long. We've been doing this for an hour and you said you had to go. Jared, can you sum up some lessons you learned that you maybe want to bring back to especially American listeners? That's one of the reasons I love these European events. People want me to speak, but I go there to listen because there's so much that we can learn.
Well, two things, really. One, we talked about already, the importance of brick and mortar, the importance of having places where you can meet face to face, have a real sense of being part of a community, even if it's a small and dissident community. The fact that you are there out in the open and drinking, singing, socializing, this is, I think, an absolutely wonderful thing that we must copy. And the other thing, we really didn't talk about Rome itself, but I feel as though I was able to absorb Western civilization at a fantastic rate in the 4 days I spent going through all of these wonderful palaces that are now museums, the Borghese Palace, the Corsini Palace, the Barberini Palace. In Florence, of course, the Pitti Palace is now the Uffizi Gallery, all these wonderful things. And I thought to myself, as I mentioned really right at the outset of the program, just how extraordinary the Italians were at one time. And I grieve to think that so many parts of Europe, we visit there to see what Europeans were able to do in the past, in the case of the Romans during the Renaissance, and of course during antiquity. And if you go to Britain, you see all these wonderful things the Brits did in the previous centuries. You go to Greece for the same reason, for the antiquities. And you find yourself asking, well, wait a minute, what have these people done for us lately? Now, that's perhaps a harsh thing to say. It is true that under fascism, Benito Mussolini, he wanted to build a kind of grandeur that matched that of Rome, and certainly for the Germans as well. Speer, the architect, he had plans for just a magnificent Berlin. So it's not as though Europeans have completely lost this sense of building something exquisite, unique, beautiful, a memorial to their own people. But of course, the fascists were crushed in the war and all those plans went nowhere. But this is an aspect of Western civilization that I think has been so badly beaten out of us. And I've been taking to calling the experience of white people as participation in this fabulous adventure that we call Western civilization. And yet, there's so few white people who see it that way. And I want them to see it that way. When I go to these beautiful palaces, or if I go through, whether you're a believer or not, do you go to the Basilica of St. Peter's or that other wonderful papal basilica you mentioned, Santa Maria Maggiore, and you look at this and you think, what a wonderful, wonderful thing this is. And I feel as though this was something built by my cousins. I mean, I don't have any Italian ancestors that I know of, but we are part of this wonderful, wonderful adventure of Western civilization. And I remember thinking there were some Chinese in Santa Maria Maggiore gibbering to each other and their sing-song jabber. I was thinking to myself, okay, this really wasn't built for you. This is built for us, by our people. Now, of course, it's a Catholic church. Catholicism is open to everyone. But I felt as though I could take possession of those places as an owner, as a participant in some essentially bloodline way that is impossible for anybody else. The rest of them are just tourists. And of course, I'm a tourist too. But I felt as though in some deep, deep Western civilizational sense, I wasn't just a tourist. I was part of this. I was looking at something that our people have done. And it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling. And I kept thinking to myself, how can we instill this sense of being part of Western civilization, having this wonderful heritage and feeling an obligation to ensure that we have a future that is as glorious as our past? This is something that I thought about the whole time I was in Rome. Now, that's, of course, a very big question for which there are no easy answers. But that was one of the other things that really filled my mind while I was in Rome, absorbing all of the greatness that the Italians have contributed to our civilization.
I feel the exact same way. It's comforting to know that some of those families that built those palaces still exist.
Yes.
Those old Roman aristocratic families still exist. The past isn't dead.
No, it's not dead. And as you pointed out, in the audio tour of the Borghese Palace, which has one of the most spectacular art collections I've perhaps ever seen in my life. If you had a museum in the United States with one a hundredth of the things that you find in that palace, it would be a notable tourist attraction. And the current prince is the narrator of the audio tour. He says, welcome to my house. It's been in my family for these generations. I'm so glad to be able to share it with you. That very, very charming. At the same time, you know, it left me thinking about something else. I suppose the Borghese's and the Corsini's, these were the billionaires of their time. But I don't think any of the billionaires of our time are doing anything that's going to be the equivalent. Is Jeff Bezos's house ever going to be something that's the equivalent of the Corsini Palace? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't know if it may, perhaps it's unfair in a way to ask that that be the case. Or what is, here's Bill Gates giving away billions of vaccinations for sub-Saharan Africans, all of this stuff. He's doing nothing that is going to be the kind of artistic or cultural legacy that these Italians had. And they were probably, I don't know to what extent they were even aware of building a legacy. I feel sure they were. They thought of it as a family legacy, but now it's become a national legacy. Our billionaires don't seem to feel that way at all, don't seem to think in those terms by any stretch of the imagination. It's a completely different mentality.
I really loved walking around Rome and talking with some of the young people who came on the tour. One of the attitudes that I loved was people said, let's just rebuild it all. Let's just bring it all back.
Yeah,
because it's not dead. That's the thing. A lot of people today love the past and they love history, but they want it to be dead and mummified. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think that the real attitude should be it's alive and we want it to continue. I remember years ago there was a fire in Windsor Castle and the chapel was ruined and it was restored. And historic preservationists, though, when it was unveiled, were angry because one of the stained glass windows was not restored. Instead, they had a new stained glass window commemorating the fire and the firemen who put it out. And my reaction to that was the Queen, who oversaw this whole thing, doesn't think the past is dead. And therefore, the events that took place should be part of this living thing called Windsor Castle. That's how I feel about ancient Rome and Renaissance Rome and Baroque Rome and all of our cultural heritage. It's not dead. It lives on in us. And we want to carry it forward into the future.
Well, exactly. We want to produce our versions of these wonderful things. What is our version of the Colosseum? What is our version of the Borghese Palace? And this is where it seems to be fall completely flat. Mm-hmm. We don't have anything like that, and no one even thinks in those terms. But anyway, yes, I've jabbered on for longer than I expected to. And thank you, as always, for inviting me on. Always a pleasure. And again, thank you for inviting me to part of your retreat in Rome. It really was a glorious experience. As you can tell, I'm just still brimming with Western culture as a result of those days I spent in Rome.
Well, thank you, Jared. Thank you very much.